Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, producer's picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during a select week. On today's show, we'll hear three segments from episodes that aired this week, starting with...
And to be honest, it doesn't look right. What looks right is for us to work together to figure out how we can make the role build and grow and develop.
Monday's episode with Jillian Hainsworth, Itina Fareed Cook, Dallas Taylor, and Maria Ta. We'll then move over to...
This is 6th annual Excellence Education Awards, but it's really, you know, give them that credit that was way overdue. Mm-hmm. It's way overdue.
Tuesday's episode with Nina and Terry Hurd. And we'll close with...
Part of what this project is a thank you to communities across the country for making the National Museum what it is today.
Wednesday's second conversation with Dr. Doretha Williams and Terry Alford. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, let's revisit a conversation on poetry in Buffalo. We welcomed Itina Fareed Cook and Jillian Hainsworth, the Poet Laureate and Poet Laureate Emeritus of Buffalo. The two sat down with hosts Maria Ta and Dallas Taylor, both who are heavily embedded in Buffalo's art scene. The four collectively discussed the history and importance of the Poet Laureate position and how Buffalo poets shape the region's culture.
I want to get right into the conversation. We have the former Buffalo Poet Laureate and the current Buffalo Poet Laureate. Let's start with Jillian. Let's just, for the hopefully the final time, the role of the Poet Laureate, how did you start out in that role?
Yeah, so in maybe 2016 or 2017, I got the opportunity to meet Poet Laureate from another city, a new Poet Laureate. And they were telling me like, oh, their city had just established this role. And we were talking about the importance of upholding the tradition of storytelling and like platforming the art of poetry and spoken word as a way to reclaim and hold community narratives. So I remember going to City Hall and I met with a couple different council members. I was cold emailing common council members, introducing myself, saying that, you know, I'm a poet. At the time, I didn't really know anybody in City Hall. Like I knew who they were, but I didn't have any personal relationships. So I was introducing myself and I'm like, you know, Buffalo should have a Poet Laureate. Like this person is, you know, tasked with, like I said, holding our community narrative and using the art of poetry to express not only the wants and needs of a community, but also to help describe the identity of that community. Finally, one particular council member was like, yeah, I like it. Let's do it. But like, you got to do it with me because I don't know anything about this. So for about, I don't know, maybe 5 to 7 months, we created this role. We knew that we wanted the Poet Laureate of Buffalo to be somebody who really represented the voice of the community. We knew that we wanted the Poet Laureate to be somebody that all different districts in Buffalo could somehow relate to. We knew that it had to be a role with a term limit because no one person should hold a narrative or an identity in their hands for too long. And we come from a city without term limits, so we all know what happens when you have one person in charge for like 15 years, like nothing changes because there's no new perspective. So we knew like this couldn't be that. So most Poet Laureate roles have a 2-year term. So we were like, okay, 2-year term, learned how to write resolutions. The common council member, his role was really to just get the other common council members to understand the relevance and significance of the role so that they would vote for it. And then in 2021, so we started talking in 2016, but in 2021, that's when it was voted on by the Common Council. And by then, a lot of people in the community had already like worked with me. I was already the Juneteenth on Jefferson Poet Laureate as proclaimed by just that community. And I remember the council members, they were like, you know, the what we want the Poet Laureate to do, like you're already doing. And you spent so much time establishing the role. So like, we're going to vote for you to become the Poet Laureate. So we had the vote to establish the role, and then we had the vote to make me the Poet Laureate. So that was like the vision behind it.
And so what is it now become? And then we'll start with you and we'll transition over to IT and kind of bridge that gap of what that role has now become.
Yes, I think the role itself, I think a lot of people in the community went from what is a Poet Laureate? There were a lot of people in the poetry community who were like, you know, oh, we tried to get a Poet Laureate in the 70s or in the 80s and it didn't happen. I think that role has become very respected in the community. I think that the community has created an inherent value in that role, even one that I will unapologetically say I don't think the city has created an inherent value for. I actually challenge them to do so, understanding like the significance of the role and what's been done in the role from the time I was in the role to now with Itina in the role. So yeah, throughout the community, there's always been a lot of respect. Like people have come to trust the person in this role as somebody who can not speak for them, but help narrate their lived experiences. So that's something that I'm like personally really proud of, because you know, it went from something that didn't exist to just me annoying City Hall, cold emailing, knocking on doors, not even knowing if these Common Council members were even in the building, to it being a role that people actually respect, people want to learn more about, and people desire to be at some point.
Yeah. And then we'll toss it over to Itina. And now you are the current Buffalo Poet Laureate. What have you seen? How did you get into this role? And now what are you seeing your place be in this role?
Yeah, absolutely. But I want to first start off by like, let's recognize all of the work. You hear that from what, 2016 all the way till like 2021. That's a lot of work that was put in. That's a lot of unknowns. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of typing up resolutions. That's a lot of trying to figure things out, calling people, having conversations, whatever you had to go through to get to this point. It should be recognized and respected. And as I've always said, like that's dope, you know, that's definitely dope. And it is appreciated, especially in our city, to have that, you know, just like a lot of other cities have poet laureates and they represent their city. So you saw something that was empty, mm-hmm. or rather you saw a space, you saw that our city needed it and you worked your behind off to make it happen. So I'll always respect that. As far as like the transition, it was interesting to get reached out to by two individuals within City Hall at that time to have me come in to talk about taking on that role. And it was exciting. It wasn't the first time that I heard the terminology of Poet Laureate. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is I want to say back in 20... Can you even say 20-something? But maybe it was like in between 2009 and 2011 or something like that. During that time frame, I would get pulled in to speak during these moments at City Hall. And I would speak to the circumstances that were happening at that time. And I'll never forget, at that time, I want to say it was Deputy Mayor Crystal Rodriguez came to me and asked me, you want to be Poet Laureate? And I'm like, no. I said no, because I had my son, I was going to school, I had a lot of things on my plate, and I didn't even understand what that terminology was at that time. But I heard about these in other spaces. And so that's like the first time I heard of it. So when it came back again, it reminded me of that time frame. And I thought about the work that you've done during that time frame, where, like, what I've seen during the time of, like, COVID and I believe, like, May 14th occurred, and the different things that you were doing and the voice that you, like, really pushed during that time frame. It was a very fierce voice during that time. And I admired that work and saw what you were doing for the community through the use of literary arts. And I'm like, cool, like, this sounds great. So I don't want to dig too much into it, but I did ask. I'm like, well, where's Jillian? Like, this is dope. Let's, like, connect and talk about it and figure out how we want to make this thing, you know, grow and things like that. But I was approached, told about what this position would look like here in Buffalo, the ideas behind it. And then I kind of asked, like, what are the requirements? What do I need to turn in order to, you know, take on the role? I was interested, but I wanted to make sure that I could commit because I already have a lot of responsibilities. And so, you know, I submitted information that they asked for, that they requested, and went about it like that, you know, and took on the opportunity to speak for, I don't want to say speak for the city, more than just, like, utilize my voice as I see fit, speak to the issues, speak to the passions, from my perspective, in the hopes that others will understand, you know. In this space, when you're using literary arts, you want to use it as a language and you want it to spread, if you will. But yeah, that's kind of how, without saying a whole bunch of things, without the certain people in the room to kind of speak for themselves, that's basically how that went down. And then I reached out to you and we talked about the circumstance. And, you know, I don't know if we're going to get into it, but it was just interesting.
It was messy.
It was interesting.
Let's call it messy. You felt it was interesting. I respect that. I felt it was messy.
Why is that?
So, full transparency, like I said, I knew the term was coming to an end. It was my idea to have a term limit. Like, I remember seeing one of the elected officials who was involved in this whole process on my birthday. And, you know, it was my birthday, you know, we saw each other at a bar. So I can't fully recount, like, the whole conversation, but he did mention it to me. And then I got a phone call maybe a month or so later that was like, the new poet laureate is Athena. And I was like, who's Athena? Who's Athena? And I'm like, who is that? Who is that? So I'm asking around, like, I know some people named Athena. So I'm hitting up random people named Athena, like, you do poetry? That's what's up. Like, I want to hear it. You know, who's Athena? But there wasn't any other information. I remember talking to this particular person and I was like, you know, well, what was the process? Like, how come you didn't talk to me? How come I wasn't involved? Who was involved? You know, they were like, you know, we changed it. So now, even though the Common Council all the Common Council members voted you in, now it's just the mayor who's going to choose moving forward. The mayor is solely going to appoint. I chose this person because I feel like they are relevant to the culture. Now, me and this person in particular had already had a lot of political discourse over the past few years, spanning from the protests of the summer of 2020 to that moment. We managed to still be able to have a personal relationship outside of our political, like, constant bumping of heads. But to me, it was like, I don't agree with what you do. So how are you solely choosing who this next person is? So we kind of got into a little, I don't know, it wasn't like a big fight, but we got into a conversation about, like, the process and about how we're going to go about it. And, you know, I was like, you know, well, what if we have a mayor who only wants to choose somebody whose voice aligns with their voice? Like, what if we run into this issue of one person solely being able to decide what voice represents our community. Like, with me, I had to get approval from all of the council members, you know? I do understand I'm an activist first. Like, my poetry is a tool for my activism. So I do understand that my voice did become very polarizing in the community. I know that I'm not one to mince my words. I know that I am what a lot of people will call a disruptor. And I'm okay with that, you know? I didn't hide who I was from the beginning. And I always was this way. But I just felt like we're giving one person a lot of power when this was supposed to be a role that's really about uplifting the community. So we had this conversation. They were like, well, you're going to get a letter in the mail basically saying that, like, your term is up on December 31st. I'm like, okay, fine. Got the letter. Everything was fine. I remember having an exhibition opening. And that night after the exhibition opening, I went to a restaurant with a bunch of people. And that's when I saw Itina. So Itina was like, oh, I want to talk to you. I remember the words verbatim. You were like, I want to talk to you, and I think you know what I want to talk about. So I'm like, okay, so you walked away. And I was like, what does she want to talk about? I'm asking people at the table. They're like, Jill, I don't know. Like, how would I know? I'm like, I don't know. So the next day was Sunday. Itina texts me like, hey, do you have time today to go out for lunch? But I was exhausted. Like, it was such a long weekend, having the opening, had family stuff going on. So I was like, I can't today, but like maybe next week. So Monday comes and I'm leaving my office at the Foundry. Shout out to the Foundry. I'm leaving my office and I'm sitting in my car and someone texts me a link to a Facebook Live. So I click on it and it's a ceremony and they're appointing the next Poet Laureate. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, first of all, yay that we're continuing the role. Like, you know, we gotta get somebody in there. But what? Like, what is going on? Like, I'm not there. Now, mind you, like Itina mentioned, I was the Poet Laureate during COVID, during May 14th. It was a lot. It was a lot. There were times where people would call me and expect me to speak to the community in ways that they didn't even expect the mayor to speak to the community. So I'm like, okay, at no point did the mayor acknowledge me. At no point did anybody acknowledge what I was doing in that role as a Poet Laureate. I did get a chance to talk to Byron Brown about this not too long ago. So just, you know, for transparency, we did get a chance to really talk about it. And I got to express, you know, how I felt about it. But I felt very disrespected. So people were contacting me like, well, how come you weren't there? How come you haven't said anything? So I remember making a Facebook status that was like, congratulations to Itina. She's brilliant. But don't ask me anything about what City Hall is doing. I don't know. I cannot answer any questions because I did not know. I was caught way off guard. The rest of that day, I had common council members calling me saying, you know, we understand that you're upset. You know, my Facebook posts and tweets were kind of doing rounds in City Hall. So people were calling me to respond to things that I was saying, which was basically there's no transparency. Even I, as the founding Poet Laureate, didn't know that this was happening today. And while I don't have an issue with who it is, I do take issue with the way it happened and the fact that even I had no idea that it was even happening. I feel like women, especially Black women, are always faced with this like disrespect. It's like you can do so much work, but then you're gonna just get pushed to the side. And there are a lot of women in Buffalo who can attest to that. Like Betty Jean Grant, she's done so much work, but you wouldn't know because people don't say her name. You know, so for me, it became less of an issue of who's Poet Laureate, because Itina, you got it. Like, I'm not concerned about that part of it. It's like, okay, you got it. You're going to represent it. You're going to represent the voice. You got it. But on the other hand, I can't just let y'all blatantly disrespect me and I just go away silently. That's not who I am as a person. Sometimes I wish I was that way. but I'm not. So yeah, it was a lot of like back and forth, but for me, it was just a lot of confusion because it was like, geez, I did put in a lot of work. I've been doing this for a long time. Like I knew nothing. I started to get, you know, comments about, you know, like they love you, but you know, you can kind of, your voice became a point of contention sometimes for City Hall. And I just had to remind them, but this role is not about City Hall. The Poet Laureate, you're not representing the mayor. You're not representing City Hall. You're representing the community.
That was Itina Fareed Cook, Jillian Hainsworth, Dallas Taylor, and Maria Ta, four influential poets in the Buffalo area. We'll now revisit a conversation on the 6th Annual Excellence in Education Awards. The event honors educators for their contributions and recognizes their efforts beyond the classroom. The conversation featured Nina and Terry Hurd, the founders of Friends for a Better Buffalo. The two sat down with Naila Ansari to discuss the 6th Annual Excellence in Education Awards.
We have Teacher Appreciation Week approaching. And so with that, what's some of the biggest challenges that you all are seeing with education today that we don't appreciate enough for our educators are doing?
Well, last year, as I served on the Board of Education here in Buffalo, one of our biggest challenges were some cutbacks that had to be made, you know, teacher positions. So teachers who had their careers, you know, and we had to reevaluate education, see what programs are, you know, working, and looking at the future to see what type of programs we need for our indigenous population, you know, to keep culture and their progression, you know, moving forward. And also with all our asylum seekers that came to Buffalo, Western New York, you know, that's a huge challenge because we accepted, you know, a thousand more, you know, that young people that came here. And also in education, you know, we not only I can speak of the Buffalo school system, not only if you look at children for education, we have like four generations of people that's in our classes right now. We got the grandchildren, some got great grandchildren, we got the children, we got the parents, and we got the grandparents and the great grandparents. We educate all of them in our program. So it's a, like we said, the whole home concept, you know, education, you know, it doesn't stop. No matter how long as you live, every day you have something you can learn. And with the new type of jobs and creations that's coming out now, like my wife, she also serves on the board of Northern Workforce Corridor.
Yes.
And we both serve on boards of two different colleges here in Western New York also. So it's education always continues to go on no matter how old you are and what level you're at. So, yes, it's huge challenges. But, you know, we got the people, our teachers, our administrators, you know, who's on top of it. You know, they're highly trained, highly professional. And whatever comes before us, they're ready to address.
Yeah. With all the policy changes in the Department of Education, do you all feel like education is actually getting closer, like more tight-knit, that we are trying to really protect our students and, you know, trying to make sure that, you know, we are not letting our students kind of fall into a system? In some ways we have control, some ways we don't. Federally, what are you kind of finding in terms of those new policies coming?
Well, looking into what our climate is like now in the country, with education, look like a lot of cutbacks at the federal level in education. And it seems that federal wants the states to manage education for themselves. So what did that look like for an average person? For the state of New York to be able to take over education and fund education, with the Buffalo schools, our budget every year is for $1.28 billion. It's the highest budget, you know, outside of New York City. And so that $1.28 billion, we have to fund education with Buffalo Public Schools, for charter schools, and also private schools here in the Western New York area. And so we got to reimagine, see what this looks like. We got to see how our governor, Kathy Hochul, is going to do and how we're going to manage monies, you know, to fund education next year. And so there's some huge challenges coming up, you know, not only for Buffalo, but for the rest of the districts that serves in Western New York through all our, 166 different counties in the state. So, we really got to get together and we got to get together as people here in Western New York to demand what we want. You know, we got to demand the funding. And not that, you know, taxes will go up. We understand that, and that it's look like it's right now with the Buffalo Common Council, mm-hmm. you know, trying to figure out, you know, this deficit that we have, that financial cliff that they ran into. But also the Buffalo School, we had our financial cliff also. So we got to see what next year looks like, but we got to prepare and manage. But people need to get together. We need to talk. We need to say, you know, what our expectations are for our children, for our families, for our educational systems, and for the city.
Mm-hmm. How do events like the Excellence in Education Awards help to actually counterbalance some of these challenges?
Yeah, this is amazing. Let's dig into this. This is amazing because throughout the years, we have finalists that didn't win an award, you know, but we think that everybody's winners. Mm-hmm. Everybody are winners, you know. It's so hard. It's difficult. We know that we see people, you know, really, really, really pour their hearts and lives into this. We have teachers who do home instruction themselves, you know, things like that. And, you know, without getting paid for it, they just want to see the child get better. And these teachers, you know, they say, okay, Mr. Hurd, or I didn't win the award. I didn't win the award, but guess what? I realized I can do more for these children. Oh. So these teachers are now, they join like the Boys and Girl Clubs after school. They do after school programs. You know, they'll do extra, spend extra time with the kids of need, you know. Or they will, you know, okay, I have a little extra change or something I can, you know, dig up, you know, to make sure that these children are eating on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example too, how the Excellent Education Awards have kind of encouraged the folks that work in the school system. One particular lady, she was a teacher aide, and then reading her bio recently, she has learned to appreciate and being around the children so much that now she has become a security officer, resource officer within the school. And beyond wow. that, she then is on her way to go into school itself to work in the law field relative to children advocacy. So why doesn't that encourage you from teacher aide to resource officer, you know, right, to now talking about being law, dealing with law around children advocacy. So right. It's just amazing how this show has encouraged individuals that they're seeing what others are doing and just encouraging themselves that, hey, I can do even more. Mm-hmm. I can do more.
Yeah, especially our teacher aides. It really encouraged them, a lot of them, to actually go get certified as teachers.
Right, yes. Right. That was one of the bios as well.
And one of the amazing mm-hmm. things that happened with this is that for some reason, you know, our awardees every year for this show, you know, we look back and the following year, what they're doing.
At least one.
A lot of them has really, really been
elevated.
So
they're, you know, like, I'm gonna win next year.
No. From teachers, now they're administrators. Yeah. From administrators, now they're superintendents of school districts. You know, they're getting promoted all the time. You know, I'm not saying it's because of the show, but it's because of the attributes, and, you know, but they're being recognized, and a lot of them are putting it on their bios. You know, mm-hmm. that this is what we receive, but it's a real promising award. You know, this is 6th annual Excellence Education Awards, mm-hmm. but it's really, you know, give them that credit that was way overdue. Mm-hmm. It's way overdue, you know, for their works. But for, you know, we read about these teachers, now they are over departments, or now they're, you know, they went from assistant coach. Now we got certified to be a coach, you know, or you know, it's just amazing. Just amazing. Right.
I do think it helps when people are able to see a full picture, because a lot of times you're kind of working in your lane,
little silo
all the mm-hmm. time. And so mm-hmm. when you're able to see as a whole what people can do and how you can elevate yourself, I mean, there's no better place than to do that at something like an award show. Absolutely. That you all are putting together, because you get to see different bios. You get to see people's backgrounds. It's like, oh, I didn't even know that was a possibility.
Absolutely.
And like she said earlier, they are so modest. They're so humble.
I know. I was actually surprised that teachers wrote about themselves, because it is so difficult. They are the most humble people ever. It is so difficult for them to brag about what they do.
They're like, Nina, can you maybe send me a template? Because it's just so difficult.
I always tell people it's better to have folks write about you, like say what they think about you, and then you can say, oh, okay, I can take that and then write about myself. Because we often kind of just, you know, diminish what we do. It's like, oh, that's just nothing.
You're like that quote that says, may the works and service I give speak speak for me.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That's how I feel a lot of these educators are. They're like, you know, I'll just let my works and my service speak for me. But like, no, we want to honor you. Give us a little bit more so our committee can, you know more.
Yeah, but when they don't do it, they be like, okay, why didn't I win this? So the next year be like, okay, if I get nominated again, I'm going to put all this in my bio.
I'm going to load it up.
And we've seen the bios change. It's like, wow.
Yeah. But I help with lunchtime. I help with
doing hall monitor duties. Right. I'm in the morning, you know, volunteer, make sure kids get in the classroom
because
or into the building, okay?
They educators do. Just do, and they don't think of it as an extra service. They think of it as something that is just something that they want to provide for the
providing
students.
Clothes right. for kids because they see that a child needs a coat, you know, or boots, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's going above and beyond. They don't have to do that.
Right. We have so many stories about that, you know, and I also have them also when the child just comes to school every day with the same clothes on or a dirty shirt that they can seriously wear or, you know, a worn out pair of shoes, sneakers, you know. So, you know, we as teachers, you know, in our hearts, you know, we always pull those children aside to find out what they need. And we give it to them, you know, and don't tell anybody else. We don't tell a principal, a teacher, a counselor or anything. Just take the time to do it upon yourselves. And this is the hearts of our staff members, you know, the people that and just know in the Buffalo schools, I can tell you this, that our teachers get vetted before they hired. You know, mm-hmm. we want to know what their background, who they are. You know, we do background checks, but we also, you know, want to, you know, their interview process is very strenuous about, you know, what their spirit is like. You know, we can hire you because you have the credentials to work with our kids, but the mentality to work with our children, you know, and deal with their stresses and deal with their life challenges. So, you know, it's a very tedious process, but we really, 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 you know, dig into, you know, who should be educator or is this what you need to do or should be doing? Because we have teachers that teach for a couple of years, they take off and leave.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, this is more than I
right.
expected.
Invested, yeah. So, or I'm going to a different district that's less challenging, you know.
But they end up being.
Everybody got challenges.
Yes, and I think mm-hmm. that's something that's, to your point, I think you have to have your heart in it.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're doing more than just what you go to school for.
Tara, right? Absolutely.
It's not right. just.
Tara says it's a ministry. It's
yes.
not just.
For me, it's a ministry.
It's a ministry. It is. Teaching is a ministry. It's
and,
not just.
And I also served on the executive board for the Erie County Association of School Boards. So I was over all schools in Erie County.
He's on the Hilbert mm-hmm. Board of Trustees. So yes. he understands from elementary, high school, middle school, college, overall education systems. So he gets some of the challenges that all these educators and teachers and educational leaders are experiencing.
Yeah.
And then how we can help.
Because culturally, I think people assume because of people's zip codes that there's not challenges.
Oh.
And so to your point, when people leave, like, oh, I'm going to go to the suburban school. I'm going to go. It's like everybody's growing
Absolutely.
Up culturally and similar, especially after COVID.
Absolutely.
Everyone's really trying to figure out how they're going to navigate a different generation. So every generation is totally
different
of students.
Yes, I can tell you about this generation, you know, now it's some of the manufactured products that came into existence mm-hmm. in New York State, like the edibles, you know.
Yes, yeah, vape. And
They're designed to look like candy,
yep.
you know, and they're designed to mimic, you know, the taste of candy. But in New York State, you know, it's not, they haven't, you know, really put, law in effect about, you know, what can be in edibles or how they can be administered and sold, you know, but we know that you got to be 21 years old. But children are getting these. They see them on tables in their homes or they see them, you know, out in the streets or something. Like, here, take these. They give them to children and each other and, you know, and the effects of it, you know, could be catastrophic. So, but these children know what edibles are and they see them every day now. Mm-hmm. And so what do we do about that? So the culture's changing, you know, different times are changing. You know, when I was young, you know, it wasn't heard of that, you know, you would take grandma pills or something like that. But now children are popping them, you know, and that's mm-hmm. something that suburban districts have a bigger issue with than inner city kids. But inner city kids, you know, you got, you know, marijuana is a huge issue, you mm-hmm. know, going to school and where is that in the bus stops and things like that on the corners. So, you know, everybody got different challenges, no matter what district you live
different
in.
Different but similar.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
Vaping and pregnancy and different things, right? So you asked about challenges earlier, but one of our daughters is an educator, and then we have some very good friends who are educators, and they work in different parts of Erie County.
Two of our daughters.
But they're very similar, but their approach. So I think educators, yes, they have the book skills, but many of them have the soft skills. And I think that's what, how they overcome some of these challenges that the students are bringing into the classroom and into the school building, because they have those soft skills where they have empathy for these children, and they're not just, well, we're going to get these this book work done. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm finding of those who have been nominated for the Excellent Education Awards. They really have empathy. They have that motherly or fatherly grandmother type of spirit to work with all children. Doesn't matter what side of town they come from, mm-hmm. or what's their background, or even what kind of grades they're getting. You know, they just want all children to succeed. And that's mm-hmm. what the Excellent Education Awards is showing me, that these folks really love our youth, and they want to make them successful, whether they're going to be a hairstylist, a cosmetologist, or whether they're going to be the next mayor of the city of Buffalo. You know, they just want them to succeed, and how can I help them to get there
and build the best and build, person that you can
build
you
the
can
best
have,
person
right?
build the best person.
You know, Nyla, I am so proud of in the Buffalo schools. I'm proud of the Cheektowaga School District, the Williamsville School
Sweet
District,
mm-hmm.
Sweet Home, because when our asylum seekers came, you know, they accepted them.
Yes.
And, you know, and the challenges, you know, for teachers, okay, now we have to try to relate to these individuals, you know, and it was coming to the classrooms, and you know, they felt displaced because they don't understand the language, they understand our cultures, you know, but they said they have to go to school.
That was Nina and Terry Hurd, the founders of Friends for a Better Buffalo and the organizers of the 6th Annual Excellence in Education Awards. We'll close out today's show with a conversation Saladin Alaa had with Dr. Doretha Williams, the director of the Center for Digitization and Curation of African American History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, as well as Terry Alford, the executive director of the Michigan Street African American Heritage Corridor. The three discuss an exciting initiative between the two groups that is set to take place in May 2026.
You know, I first just want to just acknowledge just the importance of this project. I'm excited for you to be here, to be able to share this with not just, you know, our local Buffalo community, but our entire region, because yes. This is something that you typically do not see that is actually going on. You know, so I kind of want to start with you, Doretha, to kind of give us some insight into what is this curation community project?
Yes, you know, we call it community curation because it really starts with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And we make sure that we go across the country and help people to preserve their local histories, preserve their family history, their institutional history. It's so mm-hmm. important because without the community narratives and histories, you don't have a national museum.
Mm.
So part of what this project is a thank you to communities across the country for mm-hmm. making the National Museum what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And we do what our founding director, who's now the secretary of the Smithsonian, Dr. Lonnie Bunch, we tell the unvarnished truth. We are making sure that we're preserving this history and being true to what communities are already doing. So Buffalo is the bookend to what we've started so far. We started in 2017 in Baltimore. And the team we have now, I think at our highest number, we were about 14. I think we're about 11 folks now.
Mm-hmm.
But we were going back and forth and working with Buffalo community, Baltimore community. And then we moved over to Denver, and then we were in Chicago, New Orleans, Nashville, St. Louis. And so Buffalo is the bookend to what we're doing so far in this first round of the project. I was thinking about a title the other day, and I was like, from Baltimore to Buffalo. I think it sounds great. But it's a wonderful project. It really takes what we do at the museum and takes it on the road. And we bring what we do at the museum, we place it in the community, but we work with the community. We come with a blank slate, and everyone here, whether it's the team at Michigan Street, whoever it is, you tell us the story and you tell us what you need to preserve it. And so we make sure we're hand in hand with the project. We are not extractive. We are not exploitive.
Okay.
We are holistic. And inclusive. We are not the collecting arm of the museum either. So whatever is dealt with here We do not remove it from the community, whether physically, if it's an object or a photo. We also don't misuse narratives. We do is the service to the community.
Wow. And the way that you're describing the process, I assume that it's also part educational.
Because
sure a lot of our community members are just not aware of not only the importance of this work and this project, but just also just the value of a lot of our stories and our cultural artifacts. What has been some of the challenges that you've seen thus far with this project?
Well, you know, some of the challenges really go back to making sure that we are trustworthy. Mm. It's difficult to come in as the Smithsonian and say, we're here for the community. This. There may not be an understanding of that. There may not be an understanding of the history that could actually be the truth, right? Because you can come in and say everything, oh, we're great and we're for the community, but it could be extractive and it could be exploited. Mm. And one of the issues is, we as a large organization have to understand how exploitive other projects have been. Mm. And so you're dealing with people who have had their narratives misused, have had their items purchased, the photographs, you know, there are other institutions, I'm not gonna name any names, that mm-hmm. do that. So I think one of the biggest issues is not on the community, it's on us. It's on me to come in and say, we are not extractive. We are not gonna exploit anything here. We are service to the community first and foremost. Mm-hmm. So that's the big thing. You need to make sure you have trust, which is why we've been here already for a year or so. It'll be another year or so before we do the project. It's about multiple touch points. It's about being seen in the community. So, you know, this person is trustworthy and this person is coming in to not even tell anyone what to do. You know, mm-hmm. we're not here for that. We're looking at what's already going on and the great work of preserving local histories and to uplift that, elevate that, support that in any way. Yeah. So that's the first thing, coming in and saying we're trustworthy mm-hmm. and making sure we stand by our word. And then I think the second thing is just making sure that we're embedded enough so that we can get your aunt to pull the pictures out of the attic, right? Yeah. And that we're doing this early enough, so early and often, right? So you get that message that, hey, this group is here to help view and examine this history. So those are two. It's Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. We have to show that we are trustworthy. And the second one is to be so embedded in the community that people are attracted to it, to bring their material, to bring their stories, to open their hearts and their histories to us.
Yeah. And I think that relationship building that you're speaking about.
Very important.
Is critically important, especially with the African-American Heritage Corridor over Michigan Street and the important work that Terry's doing over there, because he's embedded in the community, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, Terry, this project, how does this work in conjunction with a lot of the amazing work that you and your team have already been doing over in the corridor?
That's a great question, Saladin. You know, first, I think this initiative that's headed by Dr. Williams here is a godsend to where we are as a corridor right now in terms of what we're looking to try to do with our storytelling and all the things that we're doing with our capital projects to now focusing on creating programming. We're now actually even starting to develop a repository. And when we were selected, Buffalo was selected by this initiative to be a part of this great thing. Not only were we excited, we were ecstatic because, you know, not only are you a new way of engaging our community to participate in collections and sharing, I call it their antiquities, actually, not just objects, their antiquities to us. Again, it was a godsend. So we... You know, we're putting a lot of monies, as you already know, into building out that corridor, focusing on our four, what we call cultural anchors, the Michigan Street Baptist Church, the Reverend J. Edward Nash House, and now Museum, the Colored Musicians Club and Jazz Museum, and of course, Welfare Radio's Black Radio History Collective. they all have their own unique collections and things of that nature that we're looking to build out and safeguard and preserve for generations to come. But what we didn't have before this initiative came about was a means of really engaging the community directly. Mm. You know, I started in 2020. As soon as I walked in the door, I started receiving calls, Doctor, from various folks from the community. He says, hey, Terry Alford, you know, my great grandmother left me this coin, okay? And I think it was from the Pan American Exposition because it's branded that way.
Wow.
And I want to donate it to you. I want to donate it. Mm. And or you, I get a call from someone else who has a collection of old vinyl records of old Miles Davis or John Coltrane.
Wow.
That was recorded in Buffalo, maybe.
Wow. Right?
Or Billie Holiday, okay? And some of her heirlooms that she left in Buffalo, though she married someone here, a drummer who played and performed regularly at the Color Musicians Club. And these folks are contacting us, asking us to take these things in, these items, because they know they're important and they're valued, and they know they can't pass it down to their children or grandchildren because it doesn't maybe contain the same value right now for them. So they want to share these items. But we can't take them in because we don't have a place to adequately and safely store them or digitize them, if you will, record their existence and catalog them effectively, appropriately. So, you know, the digitization initiative that we're being invited to be a part of with Dr. Williams and her team is a godsend because it's an answer to so many people's, you know, questions right now. When these great folks came in last year and they were introduced to our community and our stakeholders, you know, then and still now, Dr. Williams, people are quite excited about when is that program going to start? When is the initiative going to start? Mm-hmm. Okay. You have folks at their own residences that have these small museums, if you will, of things that they brought up during the Great Migration to Buffalo.
Yeah.
Okay. We have folks in churches with their own antiquities and don't know how to effectively, you know, record or to share those type of things. So this is an opportunity to allow for their involvement and their engagement. And that just opens up a whole nother, set of doors for the corridor.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
We're now more than just a place or a destination to really celebrate our histories and storytelling. Now it's a means to allow folks to share their histories and stories with us and with the community at large.
Absolutely. And then you think about the future stewardship of projects like this and the preservation component of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, just speaking to you initially becoming the executive director there and then people initially reaching out to you, that says a lot about that relationship building and that sense of trust.
Absolutely.
That people are willing to take their family heirlooms and antiquities and to be trustworthy that you know what to do with it. You know, there's not many of our people who are in those positions that are safeguarding and protecting our history and our culture. So this kind of collaboration is super exciting.
Yeah.
And you said it well. I mean, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. They don't know me more from Adam than Eve, right? They know I'm a son of the community directly. But for them to reach out to us.
Sure.
And to trust us, sight unseen, and really willing to share these items with us.
Yeah.
I'm glad the doctor said what she said about, you know, being worrisome about exploiting stories. And I think it says a lot, you know, after just meeting you the first time and your team, the excitement, you know, sort of bridges that gap between trust. Mm-hmm. Because we look like them, okay?
Yeah.
And you know, especially in the current events, the way they are now, the highly charged political climate that we're in, I think this really further galvanizes the community too in such a way to say, hey, I got a story, you got a story, you got a story, and coming together and sharing those things in such a way with people, even on sight unseen as well.
Yeah, and you talk about the team that we have.
One thing that people like when we're coming in the community, it's not just one person. You know, it'd be different. It's just me walking in like, we can do all of this, and you never see anyone, right? Yeah. But we have a full team. We have our media digitization team. We have our genealogists. We have our historians. We have our curators who come with us. So it's an effort. It's a heavy lift, but it's an effort that's supported by the museum, and supported by everything we do. It's not just one person coming in and saying, we have a team, and this mm-hmm. is a Smithsonian-wide project that is supported, and you know that builds more trust as well, because mm-hmm. we can handle that lift and get it done.
Yeah. One thing that just came to mind is, you know, recently, I'm sure both of you are aware, the U.S. National Park Service mm-hmm. removed and then restored the image of Harriet Tubman and content from their website, which also boldly highlighted the agency and self-determination of people of African descent. And to see something like that happen to mm-hmm. such a world-renowned figure, right? I don't think that many people understand what that signals in terms of the potential erasure mm-hmm. of many other important unknown and known prominent figures within mm-hmm. our community. So just thinking about like this particular day and time, mm-hmm. Do you see that projects like this take on even more of a importance?
Definitely. They're more important now than ever. They've always been important. But when you are pushing against the active erasure of history, you know, you have to push to preserve it more, and you have to push to preserve it more within the community, right? Mm-hmm. You have to empower the community where that history comes from, because that's where the strength is going to be. That's where the pushback is going to be, in the community, with those who have created the history, with the elders, with the young people coming up. You know, it's very important to establish strength generations, like through generations, mm-hmm. right now, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we often have those generational misunderstandings and arguments. Like, there's no time for that at this point in time, you know. We have a program that we have a fellowship program, and we host a fellow 2 to 3 years. This fellow must have at least one degree from a historically Black college or university, and then we host them for 2 to 3 years to do this work, to do community curation specifically. And one of our fellows, Paul Springer Jr., he's our newest fellow. He's here with us today.
Oh, excellent.
We take him around, and he's, you know, we just take him around wherever we are, and so he is experiencing this as a younger person who is in this field, growing and developing. And so I just put him in there. I'm like, this is your job now. This is your life now. So we were talking the other day. He was like, man, I've never done this much traveling in my life. But the thing about that is, like, we are ensuring and nurturing the next generation of professionals in this field.
Yeah.
And this is so important. We have our elders and we have other generations, but it's so important to keep those generational connections, and definitely at a time like this, it's so important.
Yeah, and I think also him just being present in this space.
Yes.
And for younger people to see him and the possibility of working in a space like that and being genuinely himself at the same time,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to just add really quick that I think over the last, I want to say, 3 decades or so, many of us have sort of taken for granted our histories, you know, because we haven't been pushed to do so. You know, we haven't been, you know, assaulted, and I use that word, you know, not sparingly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a full, frontal assault on our histories right now and our heritage, and it's vitally important that, you know, we galvanize together now. And I think that's happening. It's mm-hmm. it's great to hear, you know, about your fellow. It's interesting enough that, you know, after the last election, you know, local professor of African descent have sort of started reaching out to the corridor, right, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to see how they can be connected, how they can connect their students. And, you know, this past Saturday, I was at Buffalo State University. I was participating as a presenter there as part of their Buffalo Black Speaks conference, their inaugural conference. Mm. And it was put together by the students there in Africana Studies. Mm. And it embodied and it really showed, you know, the symbolism of passing that baton down to the next generation that follows us. You know, if people like us, we go out, settle down, and talk to the community. We always say we stand on the shoulders of so many that comes before us. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we always talk about the people behind us, you know, passing the baton. But it's so really true now, important that there has to be more than just words now. And people are now galvanized, and they're coming together and working together to really enhance and preserve our stories and our histories that many times are embodied in these collections and these antiquities that families have that uniquely tell who they are, where they're from, and why they're important and valued as human beings.
Yeah. So in terms of when is this project going to start here in Buffalo, and what will be the process, and how can people actually get involved in participating in this?
Yeah, well, we've already had the pre-conversation, so it's already started.
Okay.
But our team will be here stationed May through June in 2026.
Okay.
And so from here on out, we'll be having conversations. We have a conversation coming up to talk about what programs and projects do we need to support that are already going on, what projects we're going to create. We have some signature projects, so we'll definitely be having all of our equipment here to digitally preserve history, whether that's media, whether that's photos. So that'll be definitely something we always do. But also doing genealogy programs and bringing our genealogy reference assistants to work with the genealogists here and the historians here to talk about Black families in Buffalo. We will have a couple of programs that we do at the museum. One is called A Seat at the Table, and that is a conversation about social justice over a meal. And so it's based on the history of the region or the city that we're in at the time. And we take that on the road with us as well. So we'll be having different conversations about the programs that we're developing. And it's going to be great. It's over a 6-week period. So between May and June, we hope to finalize the dates in the coming days. And then from here until October, we'll be back in October for another group meeting.
Okay.
We'll be planning. We hope to, by October, have the final lineup of programs.
Okay. Yeah. And then Terry, so you're the main contact here in Buffalo, I take it, in terms of people wanting to connect with getting involved in this project. How could they connect with you?
So easy. That's easy. They can always just call us up at our office, 716-322-1002. Again, that's 716-322-1002. Or go to our website at Michigan Street, Buffalo at information.com. Mm-hmm. We'll be readily out in the community. Don't worry about that in terms of helping to promote this and to really get the community stirred up.
And that will do it for this edition of Producers Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Jillian Hainsworth, Itina Fareed Cook, Dallas Taylor, Maria Ta, Nina and Terry Hurd, Dr. Doretha Williams, and Terry Alford. If you missed anything or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at btpm.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.